Welcome to the 84th episode of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck? Where we revisit great movies from the 80s and 90s that actually might suck. I'm Kalen Egan.
My name is Travis Sintel.
And we have a special guest here. It's not Dallas Michael Sturgis Egan screaming in the corner because we made him promise he would be quiet.
Which
remember?
He did promise.
You have to be quiet if you're going to stay in this room. Okay. But we have another guest who we've been waiting forever to bring on this show. And I think there's something I want to say about Labyrinth. But before I do that, I think we should introduce our guest.
Love that. Please do it.
His name is Jason LePere.
Oh!
And you can say hi. You can agree.
Hi.
So that's Jason.
All right.
Voice.
Well, that was Jason that? LePere. He is somebody that he's like, I say this a lot, I think, but there's only a few times where it's true. Where when we started the show, we were like, Jason, it will be on the show. And it's sort of a part of like, you know, we know enough people that it's worth doing this show because they could then come on the show and do an episode with us. And Jason was like top five people that
I can
made
confirm
sense.
This. In the first like three episodes, we were like, oh, Jason has to come on.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's a long time coming here at episode 84. But it finally happened, and Jason is hard for him to be on.
No, he flew down just for this podcast.
That's right.
And we can't wait.
Flew down from where?
I can't tell you guys how many times I've yelled at your podcast from the security of my own home, and to now have the opportunity to do it to your faces
feels better.
A dream come true.
It's much better this way. It's much better to do it live, O'Reilly style.
Yeah.
So what's up, man? Who are you?
I'm just a guy. Canadian guy. I think it's really interesting to be doing this kind of podcast with you guys because the way we know each other is that we're all going to make a movie together.
Yeah.
So how sort of like fitting that we all sit around and trash on someone else's movie.
Or elevate, praise, and celebrate.
Can I tell you something?
Movie.
And let me ask you this directly. Should I, this is a weird thing to put on you, but I think about it sometimes. Should I be worried about doing this show?
Oh, God. That's you're opening a 9-hour conversation. Yeah. I mean, I always have this conversation with friends when, you know, it's been a long time since I've learned to the joy of watching a quote unquote bad movie
that.
The art form of like just dying with laughter over a bad movie. But when you're a professional filmmaker, it kind of carries a different sort of added weight. And I sometimes wonder, like, how would I feel if someone was watching My Kingdom of the Spiders and, like, you know, slapping their knee over it? So it's like a bit of an ethical question and quandary. And yeah, I think that's legit. Having said that, one of my favorite quotes of all time is Pauline Kael, who says the only way to really criticize another movie is to make a movie yourself, right? So, you know, this is like our baby steps towards our real criticism.
She made it sound so easy, that damn Pauline Kael.
I don't think she ever made a movie. She never wrote anything.
Not a single movie.
In fact, her claim to fame in my head is shredding on Citizen Kane. So in print. So thanks a lot.
My takeaway on that, and we've talked about this off air, is that if we're just honest, if we're going into trash, then it becomes one thing. But if we're honest and we can levy reasons for our trash or trashing, then it feels it's in a different category to me.
I think I may have told you this, but we recently deleted an entire episode. We were upfront about this because it felt too mean-spirited in its aggression.
And Kalen was worried about offending Steven Spielberg. That's what we didn't say on the episode.
Because you have a meeting with him coming up.
Kalen's like, I don't know if I want to do that to Steven Spielberg.
He's going to download the podcast.
I just said
listener Steven Spielberg was going to be super pissed. Yeah.
I just didn't want to be on record saying some of the things I said.
I think it's also important to make a distinction because
that's not why we deleted the episode.
For sure. People have different categories in their heads too. Like we're fans. We're fans first and foremost. We became filmmakers because we are such passionate fans with such blowhard opinions. Yeah.
Totally.
And so why not indulge that in a different way than, you know, when we make stuff.
And as everyone knows, this is really a project for my son. This is for him when he's in his 20s or 30s or 40s, and I'm feeble and
or dead,
weak of mind, and he can listen back and be like, "Well, my dad was really smart."
Yeah, that's totally going to happen, Kalen. That's 100% how that's going to go down.
I'm going to have 100 hours.
It's such a gross goal. Like, it's something about it is so gross to me.
I think it's so.
I actively make myself not think about that when we record because it's gross to me. I don't want to think about that.
I'm going to call Child and Family Services.
Right.
I love
podcast.
It.
Yeah. Well,
hi Dallas. I hope your adulthood is going well.
He watched Trainspotting with us.
Hi, Dallas's therapist.
Yeah. Right.
I wanted to say one. So I wanted to say one thing about the movie last week, which is totally dumb, but it felt important to me to get it on record because it's
for
weird.
Dallas. Go ahead.
For Dallas. Did you notice that in, you know, like we talked a lot about the way Labyrinth is set up, where you see her bedroom and it's got all these like fairy tales mm-hmm. and dolls and all of this factors into the movie. And among her other like books, prominent on her shelf, a collected volume of Judge Dredd.
Whoa.
I did not see that.
I saw it every time. Like so many of Judge Dredd in her room.
That's some indulgent director shit right
That's exactly what that
it's
is.
So weird.
Was it a model or like the movie?
No, the book. No. The comic book.
Wow.
It was a comic book. So yeah. It was collected comic book in giant font, Judge Dredd sticking out of her bookshelf. I felt that was really weird.
That is really weird.
Weird choice.
Maybe they're trying to hip her up. Jennifer Connelly's too much of a lame girl.
Yeah.
They're cool.
Anyway, that was weird.
Yeah.
This week's episode, which Jason does not know the title of yet, since we pulled it, I've gotten more and more and more into this idea.
Same. Yeah.
And I think it's perfect for you. Mm-hmm. I think it's perfect for you.
I can't wait to find out why you think it's perfect.
I wonder if you will agree.
Well, it was a slow burn for me too. Uh-huh. I wasn't sure at first, but the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, I have a lot to say, and I think Jason's going to have a lot to say about this.
So now one of the things, what we'd hoped for, so the film that Jason and Travis and I are doing together is called The Crawlers, and it's based on a Philip K. Dick short story called The Crawlers, and it's our kind of riff on the creature film, but in a very different vein. It's sort of creature movie meets pulp hot noir, you know, with psychedelia. And so we thought, well, what we would love to pull for this, you know, if you could pick anything, it would be like The Thing, or it'd be some other creature effects, you know, staple from the 80s. We don't have that for you tonight.
That'd be too easy.
Yeah. But I think this is going to have a lot of crossover.
Please don't be Garbage Pail Kids. Please don't be Garbage Pail Kids.
The effects are good though.
Do you want to tell them?
Should we make him guess?
Is that I don't see how. No. Well, you could try.
That'll just be a spiral into.
Yeah, it'd be
yeah,
boring.
Great.
Be
well,
boring.
I'll just say, we've done one Christian Slater movie already on the podcast. I would say this is arguably, well, it's not his most famous, but it is the one that I think matters most to me.
Is it Pump Up the Volume?
It's Pump Up the Volume.
That's perfect.
Yeah?
It's so perfect.
Tell us why.
Well, it's because I can think of no more perfect film to ask the question, does your favorite movie suck? For me.
Really?
Oh, fantastic. Okay. So here's my super embarrassing Pump Up the Volume story. So what is that? 87? No, it's before Heathers?
I think it's just after Heathers.
Right after Heathers. So Heathers, key film in the Jason LaPere development cycle. Mm-hmm. Like crucial, memorized the script film.
Wow.
For Jason LaPere. But Pump Up the Volume, my core, one of my core memories of my movie going life was being so psyched. This is so embarrassing. So psyched after seeing the movie that when I dropped my friends off and was driving home after seeing it, I literally like unrolled my windows and did like a fist pump and went, woo! Like, as I was driving
like
home,
by yourself in the
by
car?
Myself in the car because so I was so into the rebellion and the rage. I was like, I feel that movie so much. It ranks with that memory I have of like after I saw Iron Eagle,
yeah.
Which is the first movie I saw in the theater alone, like dropped off by my parents. And I went home and went to bed and closed my eyes and saw like a dogfight on my eyelids as after I closed my eyes. Like the movie had infected me.
Yeah.
And Pump Up the Volume is in that same thing. And I don't think I've seen it since then.
Unreal.
That is perfect.
So the question remains, does my favorite movie
That's start? Incredible. Yeah. I can't believe that.
It worked out.
That worked out great. Yeah.
Yeah. I was hoping, I couldn't have hoped for such a good reaction.
Yeah.
No, well, what I knew about Jason is that he came over and it was like, hey, can I look at your records? And I was like, this is a good sign. Like, this is all a good sign. Like the music thing is the thing that you and we bonded pretty hard when we were talking about The Crawlers over what's on the soundtrack. It was like, what's on the soundtrack? Like, how do we build this soundtrack? And the idea of this sort of, and in fact, that script features some pirate radio content. And so I sort of was like, man, I hope this is a fucking bullseye. I didn't know it would be that that on target. But yeah,
I'm very thrilled, and I'm trying to remember now because I remember the stories about a pirate radio station that he starts, and the music is kind of like alt new wave sort of stuff.
I want to say it even has like super early Beastie Boys in it. Like it's
the vibe it's that going rings for. A bell. It's that sort of attempted alt vibe at that point.
Yeah. There was a radio program in Canada in the mid to late 80s called Brave New Waves that played all, it was trying to be this movie, I think.
Yeah.
And that was a really key program for me. And so I think this is like, yeah, trying to access that same vibe.
Yeah.
I'm super interested to see how this plays today. I mean, the theme certainly tracks, like youth versus the system, outsider youth gets a voice. Like that those are themes we've revisited and we understand. It's so specific to this time period. I want to know the emotion I think will last or track. The technology will certainly not. God. But I wonder if the emotion is like so identifiable. Because to me,
wait, what do you mean by the technology? What do you mean?
Meaning it's a radio station. Whereas today, I think it would be something else.
But
I think
that makes it seem more exciting to me.
No, same. But yeah. I wonder how it will feel. Because the emotion, I expect, and maybe this is ignorant or silly, I expect the emotion to move me in sort of that way, like the single guy rebelling. Got thing is like down my alley.
Well, you know? White man rebel movie, like yeah. young white rebel movie, is like
I think that's, he's suburban too. I think yeah, he's like middle class, right?
But totally, of course, it is. That is not in vogue, yeah, but it is something that we were all raised on, like reared on this sort of white, angry white rebel vibe. I mean, I remember
angry white rebel.
Yeah. I remember it. Just like I don't have almost any memory of this movie at all, but I do know it slots into that. You know, category genre.
So everyone's seen it.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I mean, your response is perfect in that I don't remember anything except being like I would always be like, oh yeah, like when I saw it on the shelf or whatever, and never watched it again. I've seen it one time. I don't even know when.
Yeah, it couldn't have blown me away this much. I will say, I don't think there is a Pump Up the Volume without a Heathers. Like, I think everyone that I knew went to see Pump Up the Volume because he had crafted that, you know, Jack Nicholson Jr. image in Heathers.
Right.
But that's weird because they did come out like almost like bang bang, right?
And is that kind of, that's basically what he's doing here too. He's playing into that image.
I can't remember, but yeah. I think so.
What do you remember?
I remember the plot fairly well, I think. I don't remember, my sister came on and she did True Romance with us. She is a Christian Slater deep aficionado.
Sorry to hear.
Not anymore.
Condolences.
But like, you know, has the posters in her room and sort of that's the idol she chose to latch onto. That was the one. She's like, that guy, that's my guy.
She's like 19. Like yeah, she's 19. Crazy young.
Whoa,
yeah,
really?
Yeah, that's what's so weird about it. Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah, she's in college now.
Wow.
And her dorm room has Christian Slater poster. She has a Pump Up the Volume poster on her wall.
The only thing I've seen Christian Slater do in the last 10 years is an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Really? She's on Mr. Robot person.
Oh, right. Mr. Robot.
Yeah. So she's on that thing now. But her preferred Christian Slater is Heathers and followed shortly by Pump Up the Volume. So it's interesting. I haven't watched it with her or talked to her about that much with her, but she talks a lot about him as someone she connects to and relates to, which I'm very interested by.
Wow.
Like today's youth. I think Pump Up the Volume spoke to her. So that's curious to me to see.
Mm. I love that.
Yeah. It's interesting to go back and revisit. I probably saw it a couple times around that age. I think it probably spoke to me in the way Kaelin suggests, which is white suburban safe rebellion. But it's, you know, the guy who is isolated at school, as I recall, has an outlet where no one knows who he is. He's a disc jockey guy who runs his own pirate radio station and broadcasts, gets slow listenership. And I remember that builds whatever, there's a girl involved. What I remember most, though, is at the end, he has to go on the run from somebody, and he's blasting the station from a mobile vehicle.
Uh-huh.
And there's people, do you remember this, Jason, at
no.
all? I'm fairly certain this is right. But he's going around town blasting like his final message to the kids and getting the kids sort of riled up, which I guess is how this movie has to end in a way. But I don't expect that part to like sustain necessarily.
Right.
But the core emotion, I think, will be a thing to me.
Well, I'm as you know, I'm crazy about teen rebel movies. It's like my if I could pick one thing to watch forever, it'd be like teen rebel movies.
Over the Edge.
Enough of them. Yeah, Over the Edge is great. Razor's Edge is great. Like they're all great. All of them are great. River's Edge is the other one. And so I forgive them anything. forgive them everything. And it, what I'm hoping more than anything is that this can put me in a teenage mindset. Hearing that your sister's into it gives me so much confidence. Like, mm-hmm. and in fact, I'm going to, the other thing I like about that is that for girls, Christian Slater was an object of attraction. Mm-hmm. He was this super crush guy. And even in Heathers, he's not really the protagonist at all. He's the hottest possible thing who becomes like dangerous and dark, you know? And in this, I like the idea. We're gonna keep on a theme coming out of Labyrinth. I'm gonna try to watch this as a teenage girl. And see,
Caleb assumes personas now.
Because I'm pretty sure I could do that. I'm pretty sure I could do that. If I just put my mind to it, I could probably do that. Yeah. But it would be very exciting to me if it works specifically on that level. Like, he's a matinee idol. He's a James Dean. It's like when I watch Rebel Without a Cause, I'm like, man, I would like watching this as a girl. I love that movie, but it sort of captures this teen mentality. And there's this heartthrob guy. Like, I love this. I love that mix of things.
I will say that I think that part of the success of Heathers and this movie for the generation that responded to it is that they were ignorant of all the things that he was so blatantly ripping off. And I remember being a young person hearing older people going, oh, this kid's impersonation of Jack Nicholson is so embarrassing. And I was like, Jack who? Because I was like 16.
So
as older guys now, I'm wondering if all that stuff is just going to fall super flat for us. Like, this is kind of the test of...
Totally. It's movie. The test of Christian Slater.
We're going to make a judgment on Christian Slater's entire career here.
I think we just go watch that movie. And we'll save a lot for the end. I don't really have anything else to say. I mean, is there more to sort of set up for you?
I'm scared.
Do you guys remember what he was rebelling against?
Society.
Just society.
With a capital S.
Yeah, man. What do you got?
I don't know. The man?
That's what I assume, but I don't remember if there was
I've heard the man is a bad thing.
Probably. Yeah. Let's go find out.
Consider the life of a teenager. Huh? You have parents and teachers telling you what to do. You have movies, magazines, and TV telling you what to do. But you know what you have to do. Huh? Your job, your purpose is to get accepted, get a cute girlfriend, to think up something great to do for the rest of your life.
What if you're confused and can't imagine a career? What if you're funny looking, you can't get a girlfriend?
You see, no one wants to hear it. But the terrible secret is that being young is sometimes less fun and being dead.
This is great. He's making it worse.
Suicide is wrong, but the interesting thing about it
is how uncomplicated it seems. You know? And there you are. You got all these problems swarming around in your brain. And here is one incredibly simple solution.
Jason LaPere.
I stand by my fist pump.
Yeah, me too. I was considering whether I was going to do it to open the show, but I didn't want to tip my hand. Travis, where are you at on this
point? I had a really fun time. There's one thing I kept coming back to, which is that we got the date wrong in the intro, and it's super important.
Yeah, it is.
It's super important.
We got the date wrong for Heathers and for Pump Up the Volume.
Yeah.
So wait, what year is Heathers?
88.
88. So this is so proximity wise, we're right. This is soon 90. After.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This isn't how I wanted to start talking about it, but I'm fascinated to know to what degree this is a response to Heathers.
I know. I thought the same
thing.
Because
it feels like it's part of a conversation.
Yeah.
And not always in the most constructive light. Stuff kind of also feels a bit jacked from Heathers, you know, like coming in through her window and his whole relationship with her and her as a character.
Bet you it isn't, though.
She's a bit Veronica.
I bet you it isn't. I know exactly what you mean, but I bet it isn't. But let's not start there.
Yeah.
I think let's not start there. Because this movie totally deserves its own conversation. This movie is fucking amazing. It's so exactly what I want from this genre of movie. So exactly what I want from sort of a teen movie.
And you're saying this is an aficionado of this kind of movie.
Well, I don't know about aficionado, but certainly fan. I mean, I know I've said this on the show. I don't know what I said it about, but a movie that is born of the mind of the characters, which to me is the definition of Rebel Without a Cause, and essentially anything Nicholas Ray does. Like, he sort of creates his movies out of the psychology of his main characters.
Yeah, it's totally character-driven, this thing.
And, it's character-driven, but it's also character-controlled. It's like it successfully puts you in the mind frame and headspace of those characters. Mm-hmm. And it's fucking awesome. And just the fact that I also love teen characters means it's like the greatest movie in the world.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, you're into it. I like it. Jason, same?
Well, no. Huh. I mean, I was very pleasantly surprised that the movie was good, you know? Because I really didn't remember enough about it to remember if it was good or not. But I think it's a very good movie. I mean, I wouldn't say it was unreservedly fantastic the way that Kaelin is responding to it. There was stuff about it that I thought the more the movie went on, the less I liked it. It sort of fell into a pretty broad cliches toward the end. Mm-hmm. And I got to say, like, the character-driven thing is a double-edged sword for me, because on the one hand, I admired how kind of just wandering and plotless the movie is for mm-hmm. the first hour plus. But on the other hand, it's like, you know, you got to tell me a story at some point here. You know, this is like a monologue.
How long is this movie? How long? Like, I sat there thinking this could be 2.5 to 45. No like, it's way. So fucking. I know it's not, but no like, way. It the plotless aimlessness stretches its time.
I have to admit, though, I mean, it didn't bother me.
Not like, at all. I have a lot to say about this plot. Go on, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, for the first hour, I guess it's Christian Slater that's really doing a lot of the heavy lifting there, because he's pretty charismatic, and the writing is good. So as much as I'm sort of criticizing it for not really having a story per se, at the same time, you know, it worked.
It kind of does to me, though. So... You take Footloose, for example. Footloose is Kevin Bacon's story, and relevant. He comes to a town, and it's certainly his story, and he sort of motivates the town and inspires them to rebel against the authority figure in the town, right? That's the plot, basically, of Footloose. But it's told through the lens of Kevin Bacon. The first 40 minutes of this film, the main character's almost... It's the kids, not Christian Slater in a way.
Yes, he's an object of attention.
Right, so the structure of the film is actually what you expect, what I thought this would be, was going to be the Footloose structure. Kid comes to town, rallies kids, changes things. I thought, I get that structure. That is not the structure of this film. Because the main character shifts halfway through the film in a way. And that makes the structure and the story feel weird. So it feels aimless, but I know why you say that, but it didn't feel aimless to me, because you're watching the kids sort of mutate and change, and then the main character shifts to Christian Slater about halfway through.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, and I think becomes a slightly less interesting movie.
I completely agree with you.
Because it becomes more conventional, right?
Yes, it becomes a movie we've seen before, but I was like, this is a kind of amazing. We're watching a town as the main character of a film.
I don't think this movie is as good as the movie I'm about to compare it to, but I was catching a bit of Valley Girl from the movie, because Valley Girl is kind of, for me, the ultimate example of like, fuck the rules. We're just going to aim a camera at stuff we think is interesting and real. You know, like Valley Girl is almost a documentary in the way it captures authentic teenage life, right? And I got to say, I really admire the degree to which this movie like just was aware of how shitty it is to be a teenager. As a person who's made a movie about how the golden age of childhood is bullshit, I have a huge amount of respect for this movie's front and centering of like, this time of our life sucks. And the frank sexuality and the, just the refusal to like play into, you know, traditional cinematic representations of teenage years. This was the furthest thing you could get from a television sitcom from that period.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, though, both of you saying that it gets worse as it goes on, I know what you mean. I don't know that I agree, because the movies, the psychology of the characters that it's portraying feels honest to me, even when it, in some ways, particularly when it caves to cliche. And this is a weird thing to say as an attribute for the movie, but it's not, I didn't feel mad at it for falling into patterns or finding simple answers, essentially, simple emotional answers to its problems, because that's all anybody has. That's all anybody ever achieves. Like, and not as a failure, but like, this felt so purely the end result of a teen brain coming to maturity or self-awareness or something, you know? And I thought that was really cute. You know, there's the other movie, one movie it reminded me of among many in the teen genre is Out of the Blue. And Out of the Blue takes its nihilism and rebellion to straight to the darkest part, to suicide, mm-hmm. to death.
Yeah.
And you can do that, I guess. But it's more interesting to me to see a movie try to pull itself out of that, even if it has to use cliche to do it. Because, like, there's no other real way to do it. You can't go all the way through the teen years and achieve adulthood in a movie, really. Mm-hmm. But it's basically Clockwork Orange.
Right.
You know, like, you're basically going all – that would be going all the way through the emotional process of being a teenager.
I think any real good movie about being a teenager has to – deal with suicide at some point.
Totally. Yeah. Well, and it does. And totally...
I'm surprised you weren't more disappointed by the ending, because the suicide subplot, which comes very early in the movie, is dealt with in such an honest and straightforward and non-cliched way, and affecting way. Yeah. And then to go from that to this, I wish I knew that actor's name, but that stock... character actor. He's like the dad in Teen Wolf.
He shows up
at almost, he's like the EPA guy in Ghostbusters, you know, and he playing this very conventional role for wacky laughs, and it's a different movie.
Yeah.
It's not a different movie. I will argue this to the end.
Let's talk about this.
Let's talk about it. I don't think it's a different movie, because this is the sandbox the movie is playing in. I don't know how to argue that it achieves a greater honesty by including that stuff, but I have to. That's my point of view. Is like, I think that a movie, it's like those things are from a John Hughes movie, and John Hughes is its own kind of honesty. Like, there's truth in terms of the stories that teenagers respond to, and there's a simple, from their point of view.
Oh, I see.
There's a simplification of authority figures. And if you're looking at it purely through the eyes of the teenagers, those have to be stock.
Right.
They're simple. And the movie's super smart about this. And in a weird way, I found myself like embarrassed to be recognizing myself in the parents.
Yeah.
And especially the parents of Christian Slater, where I was like, fuck, like that's, I know what's going on here. And I feel a kinship, or at least a sort of, you know, union there. But I was also very excited by the movie seeing it in such simple terms. And then those characters, those adult characters, kind of get their own arc in a very quiet, subtle way, as they sort of recognize the injustice of what's going on. They're slow to the game because it's a movie about teenagers being heroes and geniuses. But there are also
moments where they're just totally stupid in a way that we are laughing at them.
As teenagers, we are laughing at them. I mean, like, it's weird because the script is constructed to make them dumb. I know that. And it's like, I kind of hate it in a movie when they set up an idiot who they've made up to be an idiot. And that happens early on with the guidance counselor. But that guy even gets a moment of redemption in the end where he's like, this is fucked up. It's interesting and weird.
So you're saying from the perspective of the audience's reaction to what's happening, it's emotionally truthful.
Yes.
For them.
Big time.
Yeah.
And let's not go any further before you tell us the plot so that people who haven't seen this movie recently know what we're talking about.
Oh, that's a tough one.
Do it in like 60 seconds.
Yeah, you've heard the show.
I mean, we already said the movie is largely plotless for the opening, you know, almost an hour. I mean, I guess you could sum it up by saying that an entire high school's student body is, entranced by the pirate radio transmissions of a DJ figure who calls himself, what's the name?
Hard-On Harry.
It's a riff on the...
Happy Harry Hard-On.
Hard-On.
And because it's Hubert H. Humphrey High School, right?
Yeah.
And so he it tells the truth and plays pretty rad music.
I know.
Great music.
Like, this is... I'll do the plot summary, and then I have stuff to say about the music. Or we can talk about the music.
You can interrupt yourself. There's no rules on this podcast. Right. We're fucking on the air, man. We tell the truth.
No rules. Kayla's jerking off right now. It's weird.
He
touched his cheek is what he did. You guys know what that is. Sorry, Jason.
It's okay. His broadcasts start having real world consequences. A kid commits suicide. He phones a kid and talks to him about suicide, and the kid.
So he gets the teenagers in the high school to send him letters.
Yeah,
and,
mail.
And he has a. We're, by the way, one of the amazing things that you guys touched on this already, but it is really notable. It's worth really mentioning is that when we start the movie, exactly. he's already established.
This is the thing yeah. that I really cued into. I was like, wait, we're starting at a place I didn't expect. He's no. already popular when the movie starts.
Yes.
And then they deal with homosexuality. They deal with suicide. That's the first act.
So so the first letter, one of the first letters of consequence that comes in, and the movie's smart about it. It's mm-hmm. smart about how they do this. But that's true. He has a little rule where he calls you if you include your phone number. So there's a relatively small population that he has access to here. And so he collects these letters from a P.O. box, and then he'll call any letter that has a phone number. So one guy says, I want to kill myself, I'm serious, and leaves a phone number. And what's interesting is the movie, it doesn't, he calls him, and you think he sort of acts initially like it's a joke, but he figures out very quickly that it's not a joke. And he sort of tries to talk the guy down in a casual way, and still not really believing he maybe will go through with it, then he does. So this starts a whole crisis of conscience for this character.
This is basically the first act break of the film. I sorry, Jason, I know we cut you off here, but I this is what happens in the podcast. It also, for a movie that spends the first act with all of its characters alone in a room, it never feels that way to me. It really felt like it was paced well, and it never feels like, ugh, this guy is just by himself talking. Like, it really is dynamic.
If you told me 50% of the first hour of this movie is a close-up of Christian Slater, I'd say, oh my God, what a mistake. Don't do that.
I know.
But it works.
It works. It works.
I don't even really like Christian Slater, and it works.
And I don't really like his monologues, but it doesn't matter. It's really incredible. I mean, like, you said it's a great script. It is a great script, but it's not a great script for the reasons I think most people would think a script is great. It's just really, really smartly structured to tell these character stories. So for instance, like I read once.
I never said it was a great script.
Well, you said it was well written.
I don't disagree. Yeah. I mean, I think it's really bold and awesome for a writer to take the chance of writing a script like this.
Yeah.
Because it kind of breaks all the rules.
I think it's great on all those levels. But the point I'm getting to is that there are certain movies that are built on monologues. You know, there are movies that are designed around, like, I remember Craig Brewer saying, I wrote Hustle and Flow. I just wrote like five monologues.
Right.
And I built the film around this guy's ability to talk. And I was watching this, and in the beginning I was like, oh man, like, I don't think I'm going to vibe on this because these monologues are a little stock. They're a little dumb. But I quickly realized it didn't matter. It was just the attitude he was projecting that was the story engine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that started to evolve and change as the story went on. That was a brilliant idea. It's a great way to structure a story. Anyway, continue.
I can't remember where the hell I was.
The guy, kid just killed himself.
Right. And then, and so the real world consequences start to escalate, and eventually this like ridiculous version of the SEC, FCC, where they have like a SWAT team
SWAT descend, FCC.
Descends on the town. And of course the major, I guess, subplot or romantic plot of the movie is that a woman who has been writing letters to him that have been really affecting him connects with him in real life as well. And so and this is where it really starts to slide into, let's not say cliche, but convention, where, you know, him and his girl are on the run from the government, and it all ends in this, there's even like a bit of a Rambo montage where he like makes his setup portable and like solders a few things together, and there's a shot of a bungee cord, and then all of a sudden he's in a Jeep.
You're like, you get it.
Solder iron, bungee cord. Anyway, he built a radio. Yeah. It's fine.
There's a few sparks on a circuit board, and then a bungee cord, and then he's in a Jeep broadcasting. Which, by the way, I think is pretty impossible. I don't think that technology.
I'm sure it is.
I'm not convinced that the FCC could also track a moving signal that quickly, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. He's caught in a climactic broadcast where the whole school has sort of gathered at night dramatically.
I mean, this is a plot convention I thought that was going to bother me, but there's a place the kids go to listen because it has the coolest signal.
They say that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the quote.
That's a great line.
Yeah.
This is the coolest. One of the first lines.
The movie's like, we need a way to get all the kids together to listen in the same place. We'll just fucking whatever, you know? And so every time we see it, there's more and more cars there and people are assembling, which is, I thought it was going to bother me. I kind of loved it. And it was a great convention is get people together because you want the kids together listening. That's the thing that you
have
to do.
There are so many things in this movie that for some reason, it's not exactly that they present as cliche, I wouldn't say, but they present as kind of goofy and they suddenly evolve into a beautiful place. Like I felt this way very much about the love story where when it started, I was like, Again, like just like the monologues, I was like, thumbs down. Like, I don't want to be in this. This is kind of wasting the time of the film. I thought this initially. And then it became very – I was like totally wrapped up in it.
It also doesn't do what, it doesn't do what you think it's going to do. The setup is he's anonymous, she's anonymous. Oh, like, oh, cool. And then they start to sort of feel each other out at school. It abandons that idea.
Yeah.
Immediately.
It does this amazing thing that no movie in its right mind should do, which is that she meets him.
Yeah.
She suspects maybe this is the guy. You see her hilariously circle his picture in the yearbook and then cross it out. 1 second later, cross it out.
Nope.
So she's been like, Target? No. And says no. And then, so you're like, oh shit, now we're going to have to wait the whole fucking movie for her to figure out that it's this guy.
Yeah.
One scene later, she's like, no, it's him. And she's on it. And then it moves forward from there. It's totally weird.
Yeah. It's a real, but, so yeah, but it just misled me. I thought, well, this is going to go a different direction.
It misled you by being so dumb that you're like, this is all going to be dumb, and then it isn't dumb.
Yeah, then they move past it.
And also the filmmaking, and I would love, so we didn't say this before, but Jason, obviously, is, if you haven't figured it out by now, is going to direct our movie. Like, we know him because he's a filmmaker, and he's made some great movies in the past. Award-winning films, I would even say, about youth. I wanted to ask you about some of the directorial choices they made in this that I thought, especially with regard to the relationship, were beautiful beyond belief. There's a sequence.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking
about.
Where I fell in love with them.
Yeah, me too.
Deeply.
And again, I admired it so much because if you told me you were going to do this, I would have discouraged you so strongly. I would have been, Alan, what's wrong with you? That's kind of almost creepy.
Yeah.
But it is so honest and so beautiful, and I'm so glad they took the risk.
Wait, describe the scene because I know we're all thinking of the same thing.
Yeah,
same
I mean,
shot selection, but
he takes his shirt off and he's broadcasting his whole thing. I mean, this is one of the things I like the most about the movie because
funnily enough, I'm talking about a different.
I'm talking about the one at the high school is the one I'm thinking.
Oh, shit.
That's what I'm talking about. Where
it was shot in extreme
close-up.
But this
is important. Oh, but do this first.
Okay, so one of the things I admire the most about the movie, and earlier I said, if you're going to tell a real story about teenage angst, you have to talk about suicide. And of course, the other thing you have to talk about is sex, right? Mm-hmm. You have to talk about sex and death if you're going to tell a story about human beings, but teenagers especially. And so from the minute one, his entire radio persona is based on the idea that he's a chronic masturbator. This is one of the reasons the kids glom onto the show as passionately as they do, I felt, was because they felt like they were being spoken to by one of their own. Someone who understood that all they thought about was sex all day.
Yeah.
You know, the treatment of sexuality in the film, the teenage sexuality, is so mature. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess, which is paradoxical, but like,
well, just honest is the word.
Just honest. Yeah. And so the scene where you know, he and Samantha Mathis's character, what was her character's name?
Nora.
Yeah, that's a cool name. Got together.
Nora De Niro.
Actually, okay.
I bookmarked that because I was like, that's weird.
It's like, wait a second.
Nora De Niro.
you just looked over at a movie poster on your wall, screenwriter.
Nora De Niro.
But the scene where they finally sort of get physical with their relationship, he has his shirt off and she takes her shirt off and they're just kind of circling each other in this extended medium shot, and it's so raw and so real, and the performers completely bring it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean,
the realness
huge risk.
This is why I'm so glad you talked about that. And that is a beautiful sequence. The thing that I love works because of that scene. Mm-hmm. And that scene also carries with it the awkwardness, especially if you're seeing it from his point of view. I mean, from either point of view, because she's being aggressive and exhibitionistic in a way that is performative.
Yeah.
She is making an example that is over what she really probably needs to do or feels like
And to problematize it a little bit for a room full of three dudes, it's like a little conveniently male fantasy as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To be fair.
Mm-hmm. But I feel the truth of this because she's playing to that. And then this is why I think this moment I'm talking about is so special, is that then you get the next day at school.
Right.
And it's the two of them as them, you know, as the people who are not fantasy objects to each other. You know, they're not shirtless. They're kids. They're teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And there is this unreal string of edited close-ups where you hold on their two faces and you kind of bounce back and forth between them saying nothing.
Yeah, and nothing's happening.
And nothing's happening. And you're looking at them and it's then jump cutting to get more of this. And it's you're playing something that is so outrageously intimate and true and connective that I was suddenly so overwhelmed by this love story. And she has these things she's doing before all this builds to a kiss. And the moment before it, she does this very odd thing, which is sort of open her mouth in this kind of big way, waiting for him. It all felt like nobody's – it just felt like nobody's there.
Yeah. That's the moment I was talking about too. And it's for the moments you're talking – the reason you're talking about having them in their performative aspect the night before, which I agree with you, Jason. That was awesome. And the performance is actually – that was where I really – I wasn't super into the performances, if I'm being honest, prior to that. Mm. I thought Christian Slater was like fine. But then around that exact scene you're talking about, so into it. And I know it's problematic what she did, but it felt totally in character to me. Yep. And it felt totally relatable and understandable. And then to have them see each other, and not just at school, like the costuming in that scene was actually kind of brilliant. He's buttoned up super high like he hasn't been. She's wearing the most conservative outfit she's worn the whole movie.
Right.
Because she's been in goth clothes the whole time. And then they see each other as kids. And they have to sort out what that means. And then right after they have this amazing sequence that Caitlin's talking about and they kiss, they laugh. And it's this that laugh made me like just all the tension in my body went out. And I was like, oh, that's beautiful. They're now comfortable as themselves.
Totally. And that's the whole arc of the
movie. With no dialogue, sorry.
No dialogue. And that's the whole arc of the movie is this guy who stumbles into something important through posturing. And solipsism, essentially. I mean, he doesn't even know that he's talking to anybody, and he's just sort of projecting a false self out into the world. And then he realizes that self has consequences, and he has to finally confront who he actually is. It's just it's so simple, but it is done so truthfully.
Just to make the whole conversation ultra meta. I mean, in a way, that's the whole struggle of finding out your identity when you're a teenager is this constant back and forth between what you feel like you want to act like. You know, what persona am I going to put on to try to deal with the world in an effort to find out who I really am?
Right.
And so when you put that into a movie where, you know, you're creating a level of artifice in which you're trying to also punch through and find moments of authenticity and realness. This is why I come back to Valley Girl all the time, because it's like some weird magical moment between drama and documentary that captures real teenage life. But that moment that you guys are talking about does that, you know, it's like, and I think as a director, just the braveness of, I'm going to aim this fucking camera at these people for as long as it fucking takes for their characters to fall away, and I just see the human being underneath. And I don't know, I wonder how long that takes for
them. How the
that.
Fuck do you do that? That's my question, is how the fuck do you do that?
Yeah, because that's great. That's great.
It's so, so rare to find something that magical in a movie to me. And I mean, I love movies more than anything in the world, but like that stuff, when that something like that you catch, I just feel like there's no better medium in the world, just because that's...
And to be fair, there were only like glimpses of that in this movie. It's not like it was 90 minutes of it.
I think Caitlin doesn't like when I go into this space, but you're talking... I'm going to do it anyway.
I don't like this.
Well, so you're talking about kids finding out who they are, right? And to me, this is why it was so important that we get the year wrong, because there is this sort of sense in the art around this time that the 80s were about homogenizing the culture and homogenizing ourselves in terms of consumer culture. You have fucking American Psycho comes out around this time. You have Generation X comes out in 91. Nevermind comes out in 91. Mm. There's a sense of like we're fucking casting off this consumer culture of the 80s because it's trying to homogenize us and we don't have our own voices, right?
Right.
And so to compare that to the teenage journey, which is I'm not a fucking category. I'm not a nerd, a jock. I'm not a Breakfast Club guy. Right. I have an individual voice. And to pair the decade with the generational, with the being a kid thing is really smart and really works here to me so, so well.
Let me be clear. This is my favorite thing that you do. I don't know where you got this idea. I don't like this. Whenever you bring up, I feel it's so accurate. Whenever you bring up how a movie fits into its era, especially when it's the 90s, which is just something I happen to be attached to because of how old I am, and how that reflects onto the culture of the time and the, and in this case, the metaphor of the time. I love it more than anything. You could talk about this forever.
Well,
and I would
let
never
me talk about it a little more.
Never
speak. Great. I got into this, and this come up on a couple episodes. I know Fight Club comes out in 96, right? So it's a little late to the party in this. But Douglas Copeland sort of leads the charge in this area. And Brett Easton Ellis, I guess, Less Than Zero is 86, 85, that book comes out? Maybe a little early, 84?
Well, 86. It's the same year as, I feel, well... In the movie, it's the same year as Elvis Costello's Trust.
That's 87 or 88. The movie comes out.
The movie's 87.
Yeah, but the book comes out 85. Yeah, somewhere in that area, right?
Wow,
so
really?
That's where that's sort
or no,
of...
it's in the book is Trust. So it's earlier. So that must be 81 or 2?
Less than zero. No.
Let me look it up.
Yeah, it's got to be later than that. But anyway, so this in my mind is where this whole argument starts about you got to develop a voice in response to culture, because what's happening with consumerism and capitalism, we're learning. And this comes out of the 70s. We didn't have this in the 70s. But when the mass corporations start...
This is the perfect segue into talking about the music. But
okay, great.
First,
yeah. So what year is it, Caleb?
85.
Yeah. So there's this mass sort of capitalist consumerist movement. And it's the vapidity of suburbia, right? We all feel like, oh, we're asked to be homogenized as a culture. And the kids are the ones who go, wait. Because they're already going through that. All kids go through that, right? And to put it in this culture, they felt it acutely in 1990, 88, 89, right? It's a perfect setting for a perfect time for
the
our culture.
Era has become, in this nostalgic sense, in this reflective sense, at least for me, and whenever you talk about this, is why I love it so much, is because it creates a historical metaphor where this movie is more valuable to me even now because of that, because those two things are working in concert. You're right. Teenagers will always go through this.
Yeah.
But when the whole world is going through it, it's a perfect place to set that story. And they didn't necessarily know that this was going to be a time capsule in that way. Yeah. But God, is it ever. And
you guys caught the poster of Reagan in the back of that one.
Oh, my God. Well, everything about it, like the more you know about the moment is like the more like the detail of the parents, Family Dog and Grateful Dead posters is fucking perfect.
Yeah,
because
so perfect.
You know exactly what they're talking about when they talk about the disappointment of their parents. Mm.
So the one of the hardest things for a filmmaker to do is to try to be cool, you know, especially for a specific target audience, right? And so and kids can have a radar for that shit, you know? Like I was 17 when this came out, right? And I had seen so many other movies where I felt like I was being pandered to by a filmmaker or a TV maker that was trying to tell me what, you know, like I know what you think is cool and I'm going to deliver it to you. And I always saw through it. And this movie stands out in that regard because it actually was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And the music was pretty cool. And the music is very much in response to what you're talking about, where this is a movie that accurately depicts the beginning of alt music,
yeah,
right? Like,
I completely agree.
And kind of before maybe I even, or people even knew what alt music was. Like, there's a fucking Soundgarden cassette, yeah. Like a dubbed Soundgarden cassette. I don't think I had heard of Soundgarden until 93,
yeah.
And this is 90. But then the Bad Brains and the early Beastie Boys, like pre-Licensed to Ill Beastie Boys, that's crazy.
It's pretty amazing how predictive this movie is in terms of where the culture went musically.
Yeah,
it's,
and that's so rare for, I mean, even just the way that the amount of time it takes for Hollywood to churn out a movie, usually by the time the movie's out, the trends have changed. And
yeah, I know.
And this still managed to be ahead of the curve,
I mean,
in
this
that
is
way.
A full year before the grunge movement took off.
Yeah.
A full year, which means it was shot a year and a half, 2 years before.
And for sure, that tape collection was like what Kurt Cobain had in his garage.
Yeah, Soundgarden, Mudhoney, and all that.
Yeah.
And I think it's a cool movie and stuff, but to use the Pixies in 1996 is very different from using it in 1990,
huge.
The year after
huge.
That record actually came out.
Big
like,
time.
It is so, so on it.
Yeah.
So on the moment. It's very, it's pretty amazing. And I wonder, do we know how old the director was? At the
I would
the
love to know. Director? Now I want to know everything about Alan Moyle.
I know.
Yeah, go meet that guy.
I know. I should call him.
Yeah. Say, Alan,
Canadian, too.
Yeah,
what the
seriously.
Hell? Canadians are cool. We're not cool.
You
this
guys are
whole,
funny and
our,
nice. You're
our
not cool.
Whole thing is that we're not cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Funny.
How
yeah,
did he pull this off? And why is it set in Arizona?
And by the way, I have to say.
That's a great thing to just bury at the end of that run. Is also BPS. Why is it set in Arizona?
Why is it?
Were his parents snowbirds? Does he have an Arizona thing?
I wanted to say the question. Music, while we're talking about the music, Jason pointed this out, and he is 100% mm-hmm. right. Yeah. So we went to watch this movie after we recorded the intro. Couldn't find it. You know, I searched it in Roku. It's not available anywhere. I went to Amazon. Not available there. You can't get it. You cannot rent it. And then so we you know, in keeping with the themes of the film, illegally downloaded the movie. We stole the fucking movie.
Yeah. Also, in keeping with the themes of the film, the sound came in low and Jason made three pump up the volume jokes. Just to be clear.
You're welcome.
So we stole it, and then we were watching it, and it took about 20 minutes for Jason to go, I know exactly why we couldn't find this movie, and it's the music rights. Right. Nobody could afford to put this movie out on video right now. Yeah. It's just those rules are so strict.
Which is fucking tragic.
It's super tragic!
Let me take a moment to just beef about that. Like, it is ruining the art of filmmaking, how fucked up music licensing is right now. End rant. But this is a perfect example of why. I mean, that like the soundscape of this movie makes it so much better than what it would have been without. And the fact that, a record company licensing is preventing people from seeing it is really totally fucked.
Where do I know that incredible Hi Dad, I'm in Jail track?
Oh, that's, I know that. I was trying to think, you're going to have to cut this out of the podcast.
No, we won't cut anything. But it
Googling it.
I tried while we were listening.
It's Jello Biafra. The voice is Jello Biafra.
It is Jello Biafra. Yeah. That's why.
I don't think it's Dead Kennedys, though.
No, it isn't. It isn't. But that's exactly why I know that.
MC 900 Foot Jesus?
No, it's
the Google section of the show.
Something else.
Both on their cell phones.
Was not was. I don't know what that is.
Oh, was not was is Don Was's group.
Okay.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
It's Was Not Was?
Yeah.
That band, I know.
Weird. That's super weird. Experimental. They were not a band that did stuff like that. Oh, no. It is Was Not Was.
Well, it was fucking...
Dad, happy birthday. I'm in jail.
It's amazing. It's so amazing. And it's so beautifully used in the movie. Like, it's just... This movie's firing on all cylinders.
I imagine them having a conversation about trying to put this movie out with music they did have the license to, but you can't because the characters are interacting with the music.
They're
having conversations that are responding to songs. Yeah,
and it's
on the
so
radio.
Important to the film. It's so important. I mean, also, there's two reasons they cue into him. Is one is this guy he jerks off a lot, and actually, I was really nervous that the movie would start with all these kids listening to a guy, and I wouldn't be able to understand why. And then I instantly got it. Like, and it's a really smart way. He plays cool music that's actually cool and really good. And he is unafraid and unabashed to talk about sex and jerking off and stuff. And like, if you remember being in high school, those are the things I was like, I would probably listen to that guy.
Well, what it knows about jerking off is that you're talking about loneliness. Like, what you're talking about is solitude.
Well, and so solitude and secrets.
And so it's genius. And again, this is another thing in the movie where I was like, oh Christ, like as just like fucking old man watching a movie, I'm like, I have to sit through some kids talking about jerking off. Like, this is my least favorite comedy topic in the world just because it's so overused. No, it's a metaphor.
Yeah, it's not a comedy
topic.
They're
actually using it.
It's actually not played for comedy. It's played for character. Like, and it works. It works really, really well. And let's just, in terms of the ending for a second, in terms of the structure of what kids do, literally being chased by the man is kind of, and this is, I think, why I remembered that sequence. It's like the only sequence I remembered. I remembered very clearly him on the run with a really pretty girl next to him, trying to like speak truth to power across the airwaves. Like, that's such a powerful, simple metaphor. And this is something I think the 80s does really well. I know this is 1990, but stating clear themes clearly is such a fucking powerful move of the 80s.
That makes me you're so right, and it makes me crazy because the movies that come out now, we talk about this all the time, and this is one of the reasons why I love this cliche ending stuff,
right?
Is because people think that movies are required to deliver some level of real world verisimilitude, where, you know, as soon as something like that happens in this movie, which is totally true and honest on a human level, they'll check the fuck out. And they'll say, well, this is lame. This could never happen. We've entered into cliche kind of melodrama, over the top, you know, nonsenseville. And yet, what better way to tell a story? Like this, you use these big moments in order to communicate a message and an idea. And I don't know why that's gone so dramatically out of favor.
I completely agree. I also have to say, like, I still agree with Jason's initial statement. And the reason this conversation is making me happy is that I feel the way that you expressed at the beginning of the podcast, and yet I loved it so much, and I was nervous that you guys would focus on those parts and not the sort of love of it. I thought I was going to be more alone in terms of like, yeah, this has all these flaws. I think that are structural flaws that Kaelin doesn't think are flaws, but which is a fair argument. But I fucking loved the flaws.
Well,
I loved
that's a better way of defining how I feel. It's not like I'm oblivious to things that are being goofy or kind of awkward or in some cases bad, you know. But all of those missed notes feel like the characters missing the notes. That's why I love it. It's because I don't care. And that's kind of, I think I said this in the intro. There's certain things about this genre, especially, that get such a major pass from me, because if you click in to the headspace of a teenager, you're forgiven so much because they're so erratic and such wild thinkers. You know, I live with one. I know one very intimately. And I recognized her. She's been on this show. I recognized her in this movie in a million times over, like every other scene and sequence.
I really liked what you said just now about the emotional power of not having a metaphor, of just like clearly stating your emotions, and how and you're tying that into the 80s. And I'm just going to tell a really quick story about that that relates to music as well. So I have a friend who's a musician in Winnipeg named Chris Neufeld, and he recorded this incredible EP about 10 years ago now, where he covered, he's like a singer-songwriter who plays acoustic guitar, and he covered a bunch of 80s power ballads, and he just stripped them down to like soft singing and solo acoustic guitar. And what it was incredibly revealing about it was how, like, you strip away the 9 layers of synthesizers over all these like Phil Collins songs, the raw emotional directness of the lyrics of the songs of the 80s is so intense. And I feel like that's kind of the same thing you're talking about, right? Like the Breakfast Club, and that's another thing I want to talk about with relation to this movie. I want to situate it in terms of 80s teen movies, right? Which is a very special period in film history. But that was part of the power of this film as well, was, you know, his cutting through all of the like metaphor and bullshit and just saying exactly what he felt. And that's a way to connect to young people.
But he has to get there. I mean, what I love, and the other thing that I forgot to say earlier, but which I think is valid here or appropriate to say here, is that, you know, this is a movie about posturing, not in a quest to find yourself, but that in posturing, you suddenly are confronted with yourself. Hmm. And his fear of who he really is a big part of the story. He doesn't want to engage that person. He wants to play the front, which is a teenager. That's what a kid wants to do. And yet, in doing that, the consequence often of fronting is, you know, you're in trouble or whatever, and suddenly you have to sit with who are you actually. Mm-hmm. And the terror of suddenly realizing he's gotten himself into that situation, and then finding the joy of discovering himself, mm-hmm. is totally amazing. Yeah. I don't know a movie that does it. I can't think of another movie that actually tells that story quite so accurately. Sorry.
No, that's great. I had nothing to add to that.
That's a cool part of the movie, I think, is Jason sort of left this out of the synopsis, but the gimmick of the film, and certain, well, a couple gimmicks, but he can only speak on the radio. When he tries to speak to people in person, he's unable to do that in almost a crazy comical way.
It's a goofy idea. It's not realistic.
And I would again argue that this performance is not good here, almost in a Clark Kent way. Christian Slater wears glasses at school and doesn't wear glasses when he's on the air. He's a different
person.
I didn't
even catch that.
Yeah, he literally Clark Kent himself at school. And it's a goofy idea, and I don't think the performance is good. I don't think it's that good, but I really liked it. And because it just leaned into that idea that it was just going to say, well, look, he can't talk to anybody. He's a super awkward loner, and then he's this wild man on the air. But it's 80s. It's dialing both extremes up to fucking 12 and then letting them play out.
And I mean, I promise I won't do this every time we come up with something like this, but it is good. It's really, really good because he commits completely to both. And that the character requires that kind of stark definition. You know, he is wild, hyperactively articulate, impossibly articulate, genius,
and
teenager.
Impossibly good looking.
He's also a master therapist that talks to suicidal kids, almost talks to suicidal kids.
Exactly. And he is the nerdiest nerd, you know, who has to hide on the stairs. It's ridiculous, but it's the character benefits from that, and from Christian Slater doing both to an extreme. Like, I found myself truly cringing at his inability to talk, not because I'm recognizing somebody who's truly awkward, but I'm just like, movie, like you're like, you're killing me with this.
Yeah.
But I loved that. I loved it. I thought it was so smart and so
certain
cool.
Stories work better in tropes and in heightened reality. And like, that's just the thing that we're so uncomfortable doing now as filmmakers for the most part. I think in the 80s had no fucking problem with it. They were like into that.
But this movie doesn't do that the whole time. I think that's a really important thing to point out about this movie is that I didn't start seeing those sort of broad tropes until like an hour in.
Yeah.
You know? And again, just the choices of, on paper, it doesn't make any sense. And I love that about any movie that takes this risk of just like close-ups of Christian Slater for so long, just talking.
And by the way, not talking in a way that's particularly revealing to his character, talking in societal commentary, which is obliquely talking about his character.
It should be so annoying. Like, if you gave 100 writers this job, 99 of those scripts would be so insufferable.
Here's the genius. It is annoying. It's just that you see why he's being annoying. You love him for trying this. Like, this is a guy who checks out Lenny Bruce from the library. I know I am that guy. I know that guy. I listened to Carnegie Hall, Lenny Bruce. Like, I was like, yeah, like them, man, they fucking talk like that. Like, they talk hard. There's this phrase in
the movie dumb line. I'm sorry.
The final line of the movie, in fact, is him saying talk hard, which is so.
Can I speak to that,
so
though?
Dumb.
Because the other tagline he does is so be it, which is to me so precisely high school, because you take Vonnegut and you fuck it up. Like, I recognize that so much. Like, when you first discover Slaughterhouse-Five and just first discover the power of So It Goes, you're like, yeah, I get it, man. Fucking So It Goes.
Yeah.
And then just fucking stealing that and making the tagline So Be It is so dumb and awesome to me at the same time.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I know that those kids who steal those taglines and fuck them up.
What has your sister said about this movie to you?
I have not had conversations with her about it.
You have
but to. Now I'm going to have long have conversations
to.
With her
I cannot
about
wait
it.
For you to
I went that. from I fucking actually totally understand it. Like, now that I'm like thinking about her, and you've met her.
Yeah.
She is idealistic and she is bold and she likes the idea of confronting a social norm, and she likes the idea of individuality over homogeneity. You know, I sort of get what she responds to, but I didn't get it until the movie was in its like closing 20 minutes weirdly.
Really?
Yeah. And it's all there. It's all there from fucking minute one. But something for me clicked in at the end when it sort of started to root the characters and who they were and who they were to each other. Then I was like, this is all makes total sense to me, because she's Amnesty International. She's a social agitator. She's all that stuff.
Mm.
She's the modern version of what that kind of would look like maybe in certain ways.
Yeah. Right.
And
she's also
shy in person and very bold on stage. Like, she's an actress. And so she's sort of very shy as a person. One-on-one, but you put her in a character and she loves playing characters because she gets to do that.
Well, watching this, I would bet a lot of money that the you show this movie to almost any teenager, maybe you guys tell me if I'm off on this,
less money than originally
maybe a little less money, but hearing that she responded to it and watching the movie and feeling the sort of vibes of it, it's like this feels a lot like why I as a teenager became so in love, obsessed and in love with Dazed and Confused. Is like, I feel like there is something so true and reflective and here of reality that I cherish it. And I don't think that, I think Dazed and Confused will still work for teenagers, and I think this still will. I think that a kid will watch this movie and they will ignore the tropiness, or they'll even just not even notice it, and they will find exactly that this movie is true. Now, the tragedy here is that they can't get it.
Yeah.
And this is not a, presently, I don't think, that we're living in a culture that sort of has a steal this book mentality. Like, how does anybody find this?
I think
this?
She has a, I think it was on VHS.
Of course it was.
And I think she has a VHS, and I know we have a VHS player, so I'm guessing that's.
How did Lexi find this movie?
I don't know.
There is a DVD. Looking for the soundtrack on eBay, there's a DVD, and the DVD might have come out, like, what was the first year the DVDs came out?
Right.
And then maybe they were just like, oh, wait a second. This is going to be
a fortune.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very sad to me that this movie doesn't seem...
Because that's not the problem. It's not a question of how are they going to see it. It's a question of how are they going to hear about it.
Yeah.
Because even despite the fact it's not available, there are other films that are not available, but this thing has no cultural profile whatsoever.
Nobody knows about this movie. I think it is totally about availability. I think it is completely about availability. Is that this movie has been out of circulation,
right.
And therefore... What do you do? We don't live in a world anymore that goes hunting for the gems. I don't think it doesn't feel like to me. It's sort of you're served up a surface and you kind
some
of
kid out there
it.
Is starting a pirate internet station.
Yeah,
as we
this
speak,
is what I wanted.
And it's going
to
be
say.
Called "Pump Up the Bandwidth" or something like that.
How do I talk about this? I didn't
want to get into the internet thing.
I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
But I wanted to say that there's a way to tell a story exactly like this that uses every ounce of our contemporary moment.
You want
to
reboot?
No, I don't. And I don't want anybody to, because the movie's amazing.
That's okay.
But a movie like this would be very helpful right now.
Yes. I completely agree. And
we need this movie.
I sort of wish this was available to everybody because it's so down the middle in terms of what it's tells it's a guy who he doesn't actually say anything at all radical. He says I jerk off, I'm scared, I'm lonely,
yeah.
I don't talk to people at school, I wish I had more friends.
It's radical honesty,
like, yeah,
but it's not period specific
that's
radical.
Completely correct.
And it tricks you into thinking it's like shock jocks,
but it's not.
What's the all talk radio, it almost begins like talk radio,
right.
And yet it very quickly abandons any sense of what it reveals what it is very quickly, I guess is my point.
That's what's amazing is that, yeah, when you look back on it, you feel like you're asked. I think the first time I watched it, I was asked to imagine he was saying crazy shit. He's not saying anything
mm-hmm.
crazy.
Mm-hmm.
He's basically being very honest about what it's like to be a kid and saying it out loud, and that's radical.
And in a way that – so what's 2018 minus 1990? How old is that movie? 28 years?
Yeah, 33.
Wait.
Did I get that wrong?
No.
28.
It's 28
right.
years old.
Yeah, 28.
Okay.
Yeah.
In a
you
way,
said 33.
Look,
we're on my fourth
how
whiskey.
High are you?
I don't know
how
what
high are you. In a
33.
He's radically honest in a way that even 28 years later, to a room full of old dudes,
yeah.
sounds totally authentic and real. Like that's a remarkable achievement from a writing perspective.
Totally.
Yeah.
Okay. So now let's really put the hot irons to this movie and situate it in this incredibly important and hard to rank in period in film history of like the mid to late 80s, teen drama, right? Like the ultimate test of any teen movie is how does it rank against a John Hughes movie, right?
Yeah,
and
right.
So many movies were made in this period that tried to be John Hughes movies and just fell flat on their fucking faces because they were just imitating the surface and not, what was real about it. But it's the most amazing thing about this movie is it actually kind of holds up. Like
mm-hmm.
it has the same instincts, like it understands what is really going on in those John Hughes movies and how they're just about people who are trying to figure out who the fuck they are and scared and alone and the real angst of being a teenager.
I like it quite a bit better than the John Hughes movies.
Whoa.
I mean, like if we're gonna rank it, like the only movie that we've done of this genre on this show is Fast Times.
Mm-hmm.
We've done like Porky's and Revenge of the Nerds and
sure.
stuff like the teen sex comedies, which doesn't feel applicable.
No.
But Fast Times is close.
Yep.
And Fast Times has moments and chapters.
I would put
Fast
Times in the category I'm talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Totally. Yeah. But it's a weird movie in that it is so split in terms of its priorities, and only sometimes does it achieve teen drama quality.
Well, and then the more relevant movie by the same filmmaker is, of course, Say Anything, right?
Right. Well, by the same writer, but yeah.
But the same. I put that in like the holy trinity of late 80s teen movies. But the one that you need to talk about with this movie is Heathers, because in so many ways, I feel like this movie is a call and response with Heathers. I almost wonder, and this is why we need to know. I mean. honestly, this could have been written 10 years before Heathers. Right. I mean, that's just the way this shit goes. And maybe it was just a cultural moment where people were trying to say similar things. But this, I almost feel like this script was the writer sitting down and go, you know what? I'm going to write a grounded version of Heathers.
One thing I can say with relative certainty, just based on the way that this all folds out or comes together, is that Christian Slater wouldn't be this guy if it weren't for Heathers.
Oh, for
and because
sure.
he yeah. is in Heathers,
for sure,
they think, let's do exactly what you're saying. Let's use his iconography suddenly to create this reality version of that character.
But there's more to it than that. Like in Heathers, if you remember, a radio show is a key plot element, and suicide is a key plot element, and climbing in through the bedroom window and is right. a key plot element. Homosexuality, right. teen homosexuality is a key plot element. So one of the things that's wonderful about Heathers is how heightened and almost cartoonish it is
yeah.
with its treatment of all that material. And this stuff, the movie is way more grounded. It really feels like a conversation.
I think you're right. Like yeah. you're totally right.
But the same stuff between two different
What's interesting
filmmakers.
About that to me is that it's really smart to have your protagonist be a guy talking about the state of youth, right? Because for the first 40 minutes of the movie, I felt like the movie was about an idea and not necessarily a character, which is Douglas Copeland. It is all those guys, right? Mm. There's no memorable characters in Generation X. It's about an idea. That's the whole purpose of the book. And for the first part of this movie, I thought, oh, I know what space we're in. We're in fucking Douglas Copeland town. I know this world. Mm. I write in this world. And then slowly it zeroes in on the character, because the character was the mouthpiece for that idea in a way. And that's a really smart thing that kind of tricked me in a way. It felt yeah. like... It felt like Bret Easton Ellis collaborated with John Hughes or something. Like,
yeah. Totally.
So that's how I read it. And then it becomes totally. More towards the end as you go. And, I think what Jason and I are responding to at the end is like, we almost want to stay in that magical liminal space between those people. And as it concludes in the way it, of course, has to conclude, I was like less interested because it was it's something I'd felt or seen before. And I felt off kilter for the first half.
Well, you know what? Now that you say that, this is in some ways in conversation with all those 80s movies.
Yeah.
And the fact that I now get what you're saying, which is that the fact that it's 1990 is pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
Because the movie is moving slowly toward, rock and roll high school. Like, there's all sorts of movies from the 70s and 80s which were teen movies, which this movie is then going to kind of unpack and reanalyze.
I'm laughing to myself because I'm realizing this is the gritty, dark reboot of Heathers.
Yeah.
But it's funny. In the spirit of, like, alternative music, I wonder if the filmmaker's approach was like, I want a Steve Albini the Heathers movie.
Oh my
you know
God.
What I mean?
That's amazing.
I want to strip away all of the flash and the shininess. And again, I don't think he's entirely successful because it's still a movie, and particularly towards the end, it feels very much like a movie.
Well, it's still rock and roll, man.
but it's there's a rawness and a straightforwardness to the first hour that is really refreshing.
It also feels, to the same point, cheaper than those movies.
Yeah.
It feels scrappier, cheaper, a little bit dirtier, in a great, great way. I mean, it is very, now that you put it that way, it's very predictive of kind of a grunge idea,
kind
of like, let's take it all out.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, Samantha Mathis was not this was her first movie, right?
God, so she's amazing.
She's amazing. Great. And so they had one big actor, big actor.
Yeah, yeah.
So the budget of this thing was probably not huge.
And because it flips perspective so much, which is kind of a teen thing, but this perspective is all over the place in this film, in my opinion. But what that does in the first half of the film is it allows you to be a voyeur or a spectator on the radio station and sort of fall in love with the message in a way that I don't know that I would have fallen in love if it would have rooted really strongly with Christian Slater, which it does not do, or if it would have rooted really strongly with one or two kids, which it does not do. It plays all over the teachers, it plays with the principal, it plays with the kids, it plays with the nerds, it plays with the jocks, like it's all over the place. But what that did for me was allowed me to be one of those people listening to this radio station as the movie developed, and I legitimately was into it. I was like, yeah, I'm listening to this guy and I'm pretty into this. And especially thinking about me in high school, I would have been so into that message. Like, I even remember, this is so fucking stupid and I'm sorry in advance, but I remember the first, like, whatever. I can't believe I remember the first guy at our school who was like, "Yeah, I jerk off." And we're all like, "Fuck yeah. Someone said it." Like, I was like, "Oh, you're a fucking king. Like, you champion." But like, of course everyone was jerking off. And I remember who it was. A guy was like, "Yeah, I jerk off." And I was like, "Fuck, great. Like, you are everything to me now. Like, you said the thing." But it's so stupid.
I remember the guidance counselor who, in the sort of male half of sex ed, described the feeling of coming. It's still a scar on my
mind. I have the same memory. Are they required by law to tell you that?
That's so weird.
How to describe it to you?
Because he said it was like a great sneeze.
I'm so glad I didn't take American sex ed.
My guy described it to me as an itch you'd never been able to scratch that you could finally scratch. I swear to God.
We didn't get that.
Wait, and then the same guy was describing heroin to us. He was talking about drug. I swear to God. He was describing heroin use to us. He's like, "It's like coming 1,000 times at one time."
Oh, my God.
And all of us were like, "We should try heroin." Like, everyone was like, man. This sounds amazing.
What teacher? Yeah,
it was the same guy. It was like our health sex ed guy.
Was he telling you that, like, he's done heroin?
I remember him like, but here's the thing.
Was he selling you heroin?
He said it very calmly, and it wasn't like,
class in an alley?
It was like a private religious school. And it wasn't like, "It's like a fucking coming 1,000 times." He was like, "No, what heroin is like, the reason," I think someone asked, "Why do people keep shooting heroin if it kills you?" He was like, "Oh, because it feels so good. It's like coming 1,000 times."
Now here's a movie called Trainspotting.
Good luck. Enjoy.
That's what they say.
Yeah, that's what they say.
Jesus Christ.
Where did you go to school?
In the South. Okay. Louisiana.
Say no more.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I mean, we can get into a whole thing on my sex ed education. So be it. Fucked. My whole point, so be it. So it goes. My whole point, though, was like that honesty, I can so click into the kid I was in ninth grade or eighth grade or whatever, who is like, "Fuck yeah. Someone said the thing that we all know is true."
And it's cool. I think we've said this already, but I'm just going to reiterate it again. One of the reasons that opening hour works so well is how often they cut to the listeners. And they're not doing anything. They're just listening and they're connecting and they're being heard. You know, ironically, they're listening and they feel like they're being spoken to by a peer. And that's what makes all of those monologues work.
Another thing that I want to say about the movie, and maybe we're running long now, but is what I love about the way that it builds, and I know we've already hashed this out, you guys know how we all feel, but it builds to a conspiracy reveal. There's a conspiracy in the
movie.
Yeah,
I didn't like that.
I hated it.
I loved
it. Defend it and then we'll talk about it.
So what happens is you discover that they've been saying sort of all along, "There's something wrong with this school. There's something wrong with this school." And it comes from a very sort of emotional place. And they're just saying like, something feels wrong
here.
The
system's corrupt. The system's corrupt.
Yeah, this is what I love about it. And so then you discover in the last couple of minutes, really, that what's been going on all along, and to the movie's credit, the pieces are there. The clues are there. And then it adds them up. And you're sort of like, "I didn't even know I was supposed to be looking for these clues." The principal of the school has a scheme where she is collecting the funds from the state government based on her enrollment. And then she is expelling every student who she doesn't think will perform well on the SATs and then keeping them on the roster.
And saying, "I have the highest SAT average in the state."
Yeah.
You guys get the metaphor.
So I love it because it is so beautiful, as in everything that's been set up, like every kid says, "There's something wrong with my school." Well, at this school, in this movie, where a guy gets arrested by the government,
the FCC.
Yeah, by the FCC, there is something wrong with the school. There's really something wrong. And I thought that was really sweet, is the word.
Jason, what do you think?
I think it undercuts the message a little bit because it's so simplistic, you know? Like, it's not a useful lesson for young people.
Well,
because when they grow up and there isn't a conspiracy and it's just shitty in general, you have nowhere to aim
your
anger.
But there kind of is. Like, there kind of is. Like, what I kept thinking about this was fucking Ajit Pai. And I don't want to talk about the internet. Sure. I know that. But I was like, this movie's about that motherfucker.
Sure,
and I think it's a good message to put out there.
I don't know. I think think in some ways it's about, I mean, to me, this goes back to consumerism. This is Henry Ford. It's that you are defined by the output that you can create. And to me, it was like, oh, you don't create a good SAT score, you're out of here. And it just felt too on the nose to me and too precise of like, you're only as good as the numbers that you represent or the numbers that you execute.
I didn't read it that way, though. I just saw it as, hey, man, people, the adults are actually about money. Wait, like that's no, true.
I didn't see it that way.
I saw it that way.
I mean, I know they tied the money thing, but I also think to me the SAT thing was the driver.
I thought that. No. Well, I get what you're saying, but I thought it was a pretty cool because she doesn't give a fuck about the SATs.
She says it three times,
but she doesn't care. She's there to collect the cash. That's the whole point. I sort she of disagree gets more with you. Money because I don't
think even that's right. In respect to the SATs, she just wants to be the best.
Yeah,
she
that's care what it how is. She's the I think best. That's right. I think that's yeah. right. But and
you're
she said
kind of selling me actually. I kind of like that actually. the movie gives the kids a legitimate target for their rage,
and it kind of just reveals. That's they don't know what they're after. They're but just
didn't they
mad.
Have
and they
a legitimate target before that.
Wrong.
Like, did you feel like suddenly justified in their anger when she revealed that there was a conspiracy?
Well,
no.
You know what? Now I'm being pulled back in the other direction because yeah. even before we find out about the conspiracy, the teachers are shitty.
Yeah,
man.
Your emotional needle wasn't moved by
the
that
dude
revelation.
Punched one of the kids in the yeah. face,
and
yeah.
then the gut as a weird follow up.
Yeah, like so.
Twice.
So even without the conspiracy,
I didn't see it.
The authority
at
figures
all
are shitty
as a justification. I saw it as this is what's happening, and this is the response of stirring it up and speaking truth, and that eventually the truth will out fraudulence and greed. I mean, that's the kind
sure.
of, you know, and eyes wide open.
And I know, you know. What's I know why it's in the script, and I know why it's in the movie. I just felt like the movie up to that point had been relatively pure and didn't need that. I was. For me, my emotional experience wasn't moved at all by that moment, which means it shouldn't have been into me. Like, it didn't justify the kids. It didn't make me like the movie more. It didn't make me like the kids more. It didn't actually make me like the teachers less. It didn't do anything for me character-wise.
Well, maybe, but yeah. it gave you the you know what it did, though, is it gave you the perspective on the adults who weren't corrupt, who weren't truly corrupt.
I already had that, though.
The yeah,
people,
yeah, yeah.
No,
I,
the people who were good
did,
in that
but...
scene, they were already good. And
they were
been
okay.
Kind. No,
and it's
been
okay.
Kind.
I think it's good for a movie to say there are people who are not even okay. Like, it puts into, for a teenager, it puts into relief, and maybe I'm applying myself to those parents. Like,
you
who's okay?
Nerd.
Yeah.
Are you a
and
cool
then
dad?
Who's, and then who's a fucking, who's actually on the take, you know, who's actually manipulating the system for personal gain or personal power or whatever else you want. I think it's a broad stroke that I think is just another sort of nice, big color in the movie.
Yeah, but. I didn't hate that part. I just didn't think it was necessary, and I didn't like it. It didn't, like, add anything for me. I thought it would have been stronger without that beat.
But. Yeah, I think I agree with both of you in that story-wise...
Pick a
it
side,
was,
Jason.
Story-wise, it adds nothing.
Yeah.
Which is why I didn't like it. However, you know, thematically, I think it is great that, to tell kids, yeah, you can legitimately be angry at specific people
yes.
for specific reasons.
I would yes. say this, guys, if you're listening, if you want to direct films, learn how to assuage two writers at the same
yeah,
time
exactly.
without picking sides. It's really an important political skill.
Diplomacy is 99% of this job.
writing team.
I'm pissed off in general about this whole podcast because I came here to fight, man. I wanted to get into fights about John Carpenter or Prince, and here we are
well,
all fucking agreeing about how great this movie was.
Let me say this then. Jason, can I invite you back on the podcast?
Gladly.
Well, you better come quick. This podcast is on its
There's
way
There's debates about
out.
This. We're debating that. I think we should keep going occasionally. Kalen is dead set on only doing 104 episodes because he hates this and needs a two-year time capsule for his son.
A movie, I will say this. Here's the sort of the distant, you know, light at the end of the potential light at the end of this tunnel. This kind of a movie and this kind of like rediscovery is the best possible version of this podcast. Like yeah. I felt such joy sitting here watching this movie that I would have had no real reason to watch
yeah.
again.
I don't think I ever would have watched this again without the opportunity to do so. Yeah, this night was everything I wanted it
Dude,
to be.
Dude, this is exactly the best iteration of this podcast I could have hoped for because I hadn't seen this since I was 17. I liked it back then. I wonder if it actually sucks.
You're so still amazing. The same. You're still that teenager inside of you.
And
you
we
love.
Are going to have another chance to do this because I haven't mentioned this to you guys yet, but I am starting a podcast called "Does Your Favorite Episode of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck?" Suck.
Yeah.
And in 10 years, I'm going to have a paper bag.
All Yeah, so it'll pull. Be you and Dallas, my son. Yeah. And you guys will listen to it together. And you'll have
my
to
dad sucks. No, your dad's cool.
I'm calling it a meta podcast.
Off the record, Jason told us that he has some beef with some of our episodes. And so maybe I invited him to come back and sort of relitigate some of the topics that we got wrong. I think it's actually a really good idea and really fun. So we should do that.
He said he had to stop some of our episodes in the middle.
He's like, fuck these guys. They're fired.
It's like I need to like them enough to make their movie.
Yeah, I have to stop. You have to stop hearing their opinions about other films.
Just start burning pages of the script.
Thanks for coming, man.
Thanks for having me.
It was
a pleasure.
That was so awesome.
Where can people follow you and like support your work?
Yes.
I have a website. It's jasonlapeyre.com.
Spell it.
jasonlapeyre.com. And that's where I post all my stuff.
Beautiful. Yeah. And what films should people go find if they can? And where should they find them?
I made a film called I Declare War a few years ago. It was awesome. On iTunes, and I think it's on American Netflix. And
And it's the most thematically apt of your films for this, for sure. And,
if you pump up the volume, you probably like I Declare War.
Make a bumper sticker with that on it and hand it out.
For sure.
If you like us talking about Pump Up the Volume, there's a commentary track on I Declare War that you can listen to.
True story. Yeah.
You'll have to come back, though, man.
I will. This is good. Gladly. Yes. Good.
Well, when we're filming, how about this? When we're shooting The Crawlers, we'll commit to doing at least one episode.
Sure. We'll have tons of energy.
Yeah.
In the meantime.
Well, we did this for Electric Dreams, and it was a very sad episode of The Sandlot.
Oh, yeah. That's true. Tell us what we're going to be watching next week.
Can't wait.
Unfortunately, without
Jason,
you.
How do you feel about The Bag? Does The Bag live up to your expectations?
It's huge.
There you go.
He gets it. Showmanship.
Oh, you poor bastards.
We cleaned this bag out.
I have to sit through this. Masters of the Universe.
Oh, God.
You know what?
Hooray.
What a great sort of contrapunction to this film.
What?
That's not
a word. Contrapunction.
This movie is fucking hilariously bad.
Well, it's about time we got around to one of those. This is potentially another Super Mario Bros. In the making.
Do you think it's going to be a funny bad or just
bad?
I can tell you it's going to be a funny bad.
Well, that's great.
Frank Langella. Langella?
Langella.
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 Yeah.
Next week on Does Your Favorite Movie Suck? Find out if Masters of the Universe sucks. Probably it does. Bye.